It's good to be back with you after being away in a gospel meeting in Pennsylvania this past week at the Tomlinson Run Church at Georgetown, or actually Hookstown, Pennsylvania, which is about an hour to the west of Pittsburgh. Third time I've been with that church, a good church there. And we had good attendance of both Christians and non-Christians. It's good to be with them, but it's good to be back here again. Begin a meeting tomorrow night, a three-day meeting, Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday at Ardmore. I'll be driving back and forth. I'll be home, be here Wednesday night, but start another meeting tomorrow night in Alabama. We've been announcing for some time that we would be having a class for married couples and those who will be married. This is not just those who are currently married, but those who will be married in the future, for ages 40 and under. That begins today at 4 o'clock. Come if you can. We call this simply Building and Maintaining a Great Marriage, How to Make Your Marriage Last. And there'll be six lessons. There'll be a lesson this afternoon at 4 o'clock. Come and be a part of that if you can. And so we encourage you, if you're in that age bracket of 40 and under and are married or interested in marriage or thinking about marriage, it'll be a study that is designed for you. Let's open our Bibles to Genesis 37 as a beginning place for our study this morning. Genesis chapter 37. Here we are introduced to Joseph as the favored son of Jacob, the text tells us. And that's how we're introduced to him. His brothers, according to verse 11, envied him, and they would have killed him, verse 18, but his brothers spared him. And so the decision was made to sell him to the Midianite traders, and that they did. The end of the chapter, verse 36, said, "Now the Midianites sold him into Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, and a captain of the guard." Let's go to 39. Let's skip chapter 38, go to 39. In chapter 39, what we have in chapter 39 is that he rose in power and he brought blessing to Potiphar's household. Remember, he was sold as basically a slave and sent down there, and Potiphar puts him to use and he rises in power. So let's begin at verse 1 and get the picture. "Now Joseph, when he had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. And so Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. He made him overseer of the house and all that he put in his hand. So that it was from time to time, as he made him overseer of the house and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. So that he left all that in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except the bread which he ate. And Joseph was handsome in form and in appearance." Two things I want you to notice in verses 1 to 6. Joseph is rising in prominence. He's rising in influence. He's rising in power. And it's because God is with him that there is prominence coming to Pharaoh's household, the text tells us. But it ends on the note at verse 6. The second thing I want you to notice is he was handsome in form and in appearance. What a blessing that must have been to him, but also that must have been a curse, as you're going to see in the next few verses. So beginning at verse 7, what we have is that Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him. And that's where we want to focus in our study this morning. We want to talk about the seduction of Joseph. And I want us to read verses 7 to 23, the rest of the chapter, and then we'll come back and build three things from those verses. So let's start at verse 7. Let's see what happened. Remember, we ended on the note that he was handsome in form and in appearance. "It came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph. And she said, 'Lie with me.' But he refused and said to his master's wife, 'Look, my master does not know what is with me in the house and has committed all that he has into my hand. And there is none greater in the house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?' And so it was that as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work that none of the men of the house was inside. And she caught him by the garment, saying, 'Lie with me.' And he left his garment in her hand and he fled and he ran outside. And so it was that when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, that she called the men of her house, and she spoke to them, saying, "See, he has brought into us a Hebrew to mock us, and he came in to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened that when he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried out, that he left his garment with me, and he fled and went outside." And she kept his garment with her until the master came home, and then she spoke with him with words like these, saying, "The Hebrew servant whom you brought into us came into me to mock me. And so it happened as I lifted my voice and I cried out that he left his garment with me and he fled outside." And so it was when the master heard these words, which his wife spoke to him, saying, "Your servant did to me after this manner," that his anger was aroused. Then Joseph's master took him and put him in the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison, and whatever he did there, it was his doing. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything under Joseph's hand, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it to prosper. That's the story of the seduction of Joseph. I want you to notice three things now that we just saw. I want you to notice that she seduced him, number one. Number two, he resisted her. That's the story of Joseph. And thirdly, there were some results that came about that followed that. And those are the three things I want us to notice. Let's start with this. I want you to notice that the temptation was strong. And I want to paint before you a picture of Joseph's temptation. That Joseph's temptation was not just a mild temptation where he was tempted, as we might be tempted to do a number of things, and the temptation may be mild and easy to resist. But I want to paint before you a picture that the temptation was mightily strong. Oh, it was strong. And how do I know it was strong? And not just a mild temptation that he might have faced, and he could easily resist that temptation. Well, let's begin to consider. First of all, I know his temptation was strong when I recognize his youth. I want you to consider his age. When we're introduced to him, he was a man of 17 years of age, according to chapter 37 and in verse 1. But by the time this event has taken place, there's been time for him to rise in power and in providence, chapter 39, 1 to 6. That's one reason we read that. And then she seduces him, and at the time of the seduction, he is cast into prison. And when I come to chapter 41, verse 46 and verse 1, he was there in prison for 2 years, and when he got out, he was 30 years old. Now you take 2 from 30, that makes 28. So he was somewhere between the ages of 18 and 28 years of age when this began, of her trying to seduce him. How long it went on till finally he ran and fled outside, I do not know. But I do know this much, that's an age when perhaps the desires are the strongest in youth. Paul warned young Timothy, flee youthful lust. There are lusts for all ages of men. Doesn't matter what your age are, there are temptation and their desires and their lust. But there are some lusts that are peculiar to a particular age. And Paul warned about youthful lust. And this was an age when perhaps that desire would have been at its keenest. Paul would talk about that same desire in 1 Corinthians 7 and in verse 9. This may have been the period of time when it would have been at its strongest. Because he said, it is better to marry than to burn with desire, he said. Oh, the temptation was strong. And you say, how do you know it was strong? I know it was strong when I consider the age of the man. He wasn't some 50, 60, or 70 years of age, and she's trying to seduce him. He's somewhere between 18 and 28 years of age. That had to be strong. And I'm learning a very practical lesson here for our young people, and I learned this. Quite often we sell our young people down the road that young people are not as strong as they used to be. They're not as mature as they used to be. They're not as godly as they used to be. But you look at the young man named Joseph here in our context, and I learn a very practical thing, that there are young people with faith and there are young people with principle, just as we have young people present today who have faith and they have principle and who can say no. We need to understand we have good young people. He was a good young man who had principle and he had faith. Look at his youth. But I know the temptation was strong when I consider this. When I consider that it was she that solicited him and not he seducing her. Quite often it's the young man that is trying to seduce the young woman. It's often the young man that's putting pressure on her to cave to the pressure and do what he's desiring to do. But that wasn't the case at all. I want you to know that it was she seducing him. First of all, verse 7 said she cast longing eyes at Joseph, verse 7. What does that mean? The New American Standard says that she looked at Joseph with desire. That means she cast her eyes toward him, and she had a look in her eye that said, here's what I'm wanting to do, and she didn't have to say a word. The New Living Bible translation says she began making eyes at Joseph. She began making eyes at him. She can say more with her eyes than she can with her tongue. And she's going to say something here in a moment, but before she ever says anything, her eyes say everything that needs to be said. She cast longing eyes at him. She began making eyes at Joseph. Notice in Proverbs chapter 6, remember those three chapters in our study today, Proverbs 5, chapter 6, and chapter 7. Those three chapters, here's where the proverb writer wraps up the concept of warning about the harlot. How to avoid the harlot. Chapter 6 and verse 25 says, she flirts with her eyes. Do not let her allure you with her eyelids. You say, she didn't say a word. She didn't have to. She can cast those longing eyes and look in such a way, and she has the look in her eye that says, here's what I'm willing to do, and I know that's what you want to do as well. She casts longing eyes at Joseph. She's seducing him. Or it may mean, as some have suggested, that she set her eye on him as a target. Some commentators think it doesn't mean she made eyes at him. She very well may, and probably did. But it means some, in the eyes of some, that she set a target on him and she set her eye on him, and he's the one I'm going to break down, and he's the one that's going to succumb to my pressure. In either case, it is she that is seducing him. Thirdly, the temptation was strong. You say, how do you know it was strong? You know it was strong. How strong was it? Well, it was strong because I consider his youth. I consider the fact that it was she that was soliciting him. And thirdly, she told him how far she was willing to go. She was not toying. She was not flirting only to turn out to be a tease. She's not the girl that would begin to tease and toy with him, and then when he says, okay, I think I'm ready, and she says, oh, no, we can't do that. That doesn't go on with the case of Potiphar's wife. Here's what she said. She said, are you reading with me at verse 7? She said, come lie with me. Here's what I'm willing to do with you. And as if that's not enough, she begins to reach for him and grab for him and grabbed his coat, and she said at verse 12, come lie with me. Here's what I'm willing to do. Here's how far I'm willing to go. And I'm here to tell you, there were very few young men in Egypt that could have resisted that kind of pressure. Think of the immorality that was rampant throughout Egypt, and there would be very few young men that could have said no to that. They might have said no to the longing eyes. I want you to think about how young he was, and I want you to think she's been making eyes at him. And she's been flirting with him, and she's been toying with him. And then she says, here's what I'm willing to do. And then she reaches for him, and she grabs him and says, come lie with me. Oh, the temptation was strong. But I want to suggest to you something else that made it strong was the repetition thereof. The temptation was strong when you realize that this wasn't something that just happened one time, but it went on and on again. I want to suggest to you that resistance at first is quite easy to resist. And that's true of all of us, whatever the temptation may be. The temptation to lie, the first inclination to do that, you say, oh, no, I can do that. But when the pressure's on, you make hay. Let me give you evidence of that. Eve resisted at first, didn't she? You remember when Satan came to her and said, here's the and I'm paraphrasing, here's the fruit, and I want you to eat of that fruit. And she said, we can't do that. Well, why can't you? Because God said, in the day we eat of it, we'll surely die. We can't do that. He said, well, you know that in the day you eat of it, you'll have no good from evil. You know that. She said no at first, but then she finally caved. Another example. Samson resisted Delilah, didn't he? And didn't he resist her again? And didn't he resist her again? And didn't he resist her again? But he finally caved to her pressure. And what I'm suggesting is that there is something about the mounting of pressure again and again and again and again and again. And resisting at first may be easy. But I want you to notice with me at verse 10. Genesis 39 and verse 10, and so it was that as she spoke to Joseph day by day. That means it was continual and it was daily. She made eyes at him, and that wasn't just one time, but another day she would make eyes at him, and another day she makes eyes at him, and another day she flirts with him, and she says to him, come lie with me. He says, no. She says, well, then the next day, come lie with me. And he says, no. And she says another day, come lie with me. The mounting pressure is building. Oh, the temptation was strong. And I want to suggest to you that from Satan's point of view, that is designed to wear him down. Let's go to Proverbs 6. Remember the three chapters we said we'd talk about? Let's go to the sixth division of the book of Proverbs, and I want you to notice the warning. And this, by the way, is advice given to a young man. This is how the harlot operates. And you say, well, I don't know any harlots. God is using any person to be a harlot that would be a temptation to you. Your boyfriend, your girlfriend, whatever the case may be. By means of a harlot, a man is reduced to a crust of bread. All that pressure she puts on with the eyes, with the flattering tongue, the attire of the harlot, chapter 7. It's designed to break him down like a crust of bread. You take a piece of toast that's been cooked a little too long, and you can just take it and you crumble it and it becomes nothing. That's what she does to the man. She reduces him to a crust of bread. And from Satan's point of view, this continual daily repetition thereof is designed to wear him down and break him down. He probably is going to say no at first. He may say no the second time. He may say a no a third time, but somewhere he'll give. Satan thinks. The temptation was strong. How do you know? I know the temptation was strong when I recognized the convenient opportunity that was presented in the case of Joseph. Now, the fact that one could easily get caught serves as a deterrent. You recognize that. If you were tempted to steal and you thought people are watching and people are looking, then I don't think I'm going to reach and steal that money. When cameras are up and around and you recognize I'm going to be caught on film, you would not, if you were even tempted at all, you'd say, well, the fact that I'm going to get caught and someone might see me would cause you to say, I don't think I want to be involved. The case of fornication, if you thought you could do it and get away with it, nobody know, it's certainly a stronger temptation than when you think people are watching. If you thought cameras are all around and we'll get caught and there will be a record of this and we'll get busted over this, well, then you probably are going to resist the temptation. But that wasn't the case here. I want you to notice it, verse 11. Genesis 39 and verse 11. Verse 11 said, so it happened about that time that Joseph went into the house to do his work and none of the men of the house was inside. Now we have a danger. Did you notice that? Joseph went into the house and none of the men of the house was inside. They're all alone. They're all alone. And she's going to seize the opportunity of being all alone. There's a principle involved here. Being alone is quite enticing when the temptation becomes strong. Remember 5, 6, and 7? We've looked at 5. We've talked about 6. Let's go to 7 now. Let's go to Proverbs 7. In Proverbs 7, this is the harlot that comes out to the young man and said, you're the only one for me. I've been waiting for you all my life. She's lying through her teeth, of course. But here's what she says to him. She says at verse 18, come, let us fill our love to the morning. Let us delight ourselves with love. She's putting the pressure on. You know what else she says? Look at verse 19. My husband's not at home. She's a married woman. And if you're worried about getting caught, if you're worrying about my husband finding you, there is a convenient opportunity. We won't get caught. How do you know we won't get caught? Look at verse 19. My husband's not at home. But what if he comes in? Well, he's gone on a long journey, and he took a bag of money with him. He took his traveler's checks with him. He's going to be gone for a while. How do you know he's going to be gone? Well, he took this bag of money with him, and then he said, look at verse 20, he said he'd come home on an appointed day. He said he had a two-week trip, and he's gone, and he took his bag of money with him, and we won't get caught. We have every opportunity, and no one is around, and now is our time. Oh, the temptation was strong, wasn't it? I want you to consider the fact that being alone, there's a danger of being alone when no one else is around. And I learned that from this context right here. That's when she began to cry out and say, come lie with me. And she reached and grabbed for his garment and said, come lie with me. When you're in that car and no one else is around, and it's been parked for a while, the temptation becomes stronger. When you're in that apartment and you're in that room and you're in that living room and no one else is in the house, the temptation becomes stronger. And I'm trying to paint for you a picture of how strong this temptation was for Joseph. This wasn't a slight temptation where the pressure was put on in this for a little bit and then he said, you know, that wasn't all that hard. But oh, was it strong? How strong was it? Well, consider his youth. He was a young man of somewhere 18 to 28 years of age. Consider the fact that it was she that was putting pressure on him. And thirdly, consider the fact she says, here's how far I'm willing to go. Come lie with me, she said. And that wasn't one time, but this went on and on and on. And finally now, no one else is around, and she reaches for him and grabs him to embrace him and says, come lie with me. Secondly, I want you to consider equal to the strength of that temptation was the fact that the resistance was firm. The temptation was strong, but the resistance was firm. How did he resist? Well, I want you to notice, first of all, that Joseph resisted with words. He had somewhat to say. And in fact, he had five things to say about that. Here's the first thing he said. Are you reading with me at verse 8? First of all, he said, no, I'm not going to do that. Look with me at Genesis 39 and verse 8. Verse 8 said, but he, and you might underline, refused. It means he said no. She says, come lie with me. He said, no, I'm not going to do that. Look at verse 10. Look at verse 10. Verse 10 says, and so it was that she spoke to Joseph day by day that he did not heed her. That means he said no. And he meant no. Those of you who are old enough to remember the days of the Reagan administration in the 1980s when Nancy Reagan, the first lady, had as her cause of campaign against drugs, her campaign slogan was, just say no. And she was heavily criticized by that, or about that, because you can't just say no to things like drugs and immorality. You can't do that. And the question of many of those who are conservative-minded religious people kept asking the question, why can't you say no to drugs? Why can't you say no to drinking? Why can't you say no to immorality? Why can't you say no to fornication? Why can't you say no to homosexuality? And on down the line we go. Why can't you say no? Joseph did. He had something to say. He said no. That's not all he said. He spoke of trust. Look at verse 8 with me, if you will. He refused, and he said to the master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, but has committed all that he has into my hand. My master don't know what I do at every moment, but he trusts me. That's what he's saying. Somebody trusts me, and I do not want to betray that trust. Listen to me, young person, if you will. When you're on a date, your parents trust you to do exactly what you ought to do. They trust you. Don't betray that trust. Husbands, when your wife's not around and she's gone or you're on a business trip, you remember this. She trusts you to behave yourself. Don't betray that trust. Wives, when he's gone, he's not there. Your husband trusts you. Parents, your children trust you to conduct yourself in the way that you taught them. He spoke of trust, but that's not all. Look at verse 9. He spoke of the sacredness of marriage. He said, verse 9, none is greater in the house than I. He's kept back nothing from me but you, because you are his wife. You're a married woman. My master said I could have anything I wanted. I could touch anything, handle anything, I could use anything. But you, it's because you're a married woman. You're his wife. There's something sacred about marriage. And I'm not going to betray that trust, he said. But that's not all he said. Look with me at verse 9. He said, how can I do this great wickedness? It's evil. It's immoral. This is something immoral. This is not just a violation of code. This is not against policy. It's immoral. And the fifth thing he said, and it is a sin against God. I want you to think about that for a moment. When someone commits the sin of adultery, we get all up in arms, and correctly so, that we say, oh, that's terrible of what he's done to his wife. What she has done to her husband. They've broken the marriage yet. When adultery is committed, it is not just the fact that she's a married woman or he's a married man. It's not merely that they're breaking the marriage vows. It's not merely that the vows have been broken. It is not merely that one has been untrue and unfaithful. It is the fact they have sinned against God. That's the worst part of it all. They've sinned against God. Joseph had quite a bit to say, didn't he? He resisted with words. He said, no, I'm not going to do it. My master trusts me. I don't want to betray the trust. You're a married woman. And furthermore, that would be immoral, it's wicked, and it's a sin against God. No, I'm not going to do it. But that's not all. I want you to notice something else. He resisted with deeds. And his deeds put some teeth into his words and shows that his words meant something. His words meant something. What did he do? First of all, he refused to be with her. Perhaps you've missed this from time to time. I did for a number of years. Look at verse 10. So it was, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her. But that's not all the verse says. Or to be with her. Have you thought about that phrase? He not only refused to lie with her, but to be with her was more than, or something in addition to, or separate from lying with her. That he not only refused, I'm not going to have this relationship with her, but the text says that he refused to even be with her. The International translates that. Living Bible says he kept out of her way as much as possible. He understood that danger. Remember the temptation being strong because no one else was around. He understood the danger of all of that. He understood the danger of association with someone of the opposite sex when no one else is around. He understood that if you hang around and you hang around and you keep hanging around, that could easily lead to greater temptation. And the next thing you know, we might succumb to the temptation and we might be guilty of immorality. Let's go back to Proverbs 5. Remember those three chapters? Look at Proverbs 5 and verse 8. Do not go near the door of her house. Remove yourself far from her. And then he adds, do not go near the door of her house. What Joseph did in his actions was, after she began to make eyes at him and she began to cry out, come lie with me. He didn't go by where she was working just to see if she's going to cut those eyes again. He didn't go out in the garden where she was just to see if she calls out again to me and says, come lie with me. I'll run away, but I just want to see if she'll say that. That means that person that is a temptation to you and has put pressure upon you, you stay clear of them as much as you can. That's a Bible principle. Remove yourself far from her. Do not go near the door of her house. If that person is at work, you don't go by their cubicle. You don't go by their station. You don't go by their place of employment and see, let me just see if they'll say anything. I want to see if they even get eye contact from them. I'm not going to do it. I just want to see them. Joseph resisted with deeds. He refused to even be with her. And then I want you to notice this at verse 12. Verse 12 says, he fled and he ran outside. That's the part of the story we remember most. Literally, he did that. That's a literal running outside. It wasn't symbolically that he got himself away, but he literally got up and he ran outside, the text said. He removed himself from the temptation. His action shows that his words were real. When I said no, I meant no. And when I said my master trust me, I do not want to betray that trust. And when I said this is immoral and sin against God, I meant immoral and sin against God. I meant no. He fled and he ran outside. Listen to me carefully. That may mean you're going to have to leave the house. Literally sometime, folks. Young person, you may have to get up and leave the house and say, I'm going to go outside. I'm going to go call somebody to come and get me. I'm going to run next door. You may have to leave the car. You may have to leave the room. And you say, oh, that would be embarrassing to call my parents to come and get me or a friend to come and get me, and I had to run outside. I want to tell you something more embarrassing, coming up pregnant out of wedlock. And confessing before others, I have sinned against God. That's more embarrassing. It'd be less embarrassing to say, you know what, I kept myself pure, but I ran and I fled outside. It's what Joseph did. He ran and he fled outside. But thirdly, he resisted promptly. Notice the text says that when she said, lie with me, the text said, but he refused. Verse 12, when she reached for him, he fled and ran outside. That means he resisted without the slightest hesitation, without dallying with the temptation to see how far she may be willing to go. No waiting to see if perhaps she's real in this. Let me toy with this just a little bit and let's see. She says, come lie with me. I'm wondering if how far this will go before she'll holler quit. He didn't play with it. He didn't toy with it. And I want to suggest to you that he resisted firmly. He resisted firmly. There was no wavering. There was no indecision. I don't know, should we, should we not? Maybe. No pushing aside something he secretly desired to do. But this text reveals to me Joseph said no, and he meant no, and he followed through with his deeds. I'm here to tell you that his resistance was equal to that of the strength of the temptation. The resistance was firm. How so? He resisted with words. Remember the words he said? He said, no. He said, my master, trust me. You're a married woman. This would be immoral. It's a sin against God. That's the five things he said. He resisted with deeds. He stayed clear from her. And then he fled and he ran outside. He resisted promptly and he resisted firmly. But thirdly and finally, the temptation was strong. The resistance was firm. And the result was clear. I want to tell you, when Joseph fled and ran outside and things settled down and the dust is all settled from his path, Joseph can stand on the outside and he can look back and he can see three things. Perhaps more, but I know of three things he can see with greater clarity than he's ever seen before. You say, well, I think Joseph probably knew some of this before. He may have. But I want to tell you, he understands it now better than he's ever understood it. The results are clear. When he gets outside and he looks back, there are three things he sees with greater clarity. Like what? First of all, I want to suggest to you, he now can see the difference between love and lust. Joseph might have understood that all along. I don't know. He might have been thinking, she doesn't have any love for me. She just filled with lust. He might have thought that. But I know he knows it now. And I want you to understand this woman lusted for him, but she did not love him at all. And you say, what evidence do you have? Her effort to lie and destroy him. Let's begin at verse 14. Do you remember when he fled and ran outside? She's left with his garment. And she's going to do something with that. Well, she did. She called him into the house and she said, look at verse 14. See, he has brought in a Hebrew to mock us, and he came in to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. He tried to rape me. That's what she's saying. You know what this man did, the man that owns this garment? Here's the evidence. I've got the evidence right here in my hand. His garment is in my hand. He came into my room, and he tried to rape me. He tried to attack me, and when I screamed and I hollered, verse 15, then he fled and went outside. She's lying. It was she that was seducing him. But she's made the charge toward him. She's lying about him. She's trying to destroy him. That's not enough. That's not enough. Notice beginning at verse 17. When Potiphar comes home, she comes to Potiphar and she said, I still have the garment right here. And that Hebrew that you brought into us, he tried to rape me. And I screamed and I hollered and he ran and fled outside. Enraged the master to the point he put him in prison. And I'm suggesting to you the fact that she lied and she had made every effort to destroy him is every kind of evidence that she had no love or consideration or care for him, but she did lust for him. Pulpit well said, indeed, all illicit passion, whether gratified or balked, has a tendency sooner or later to be transformed into hate. I say amen. whatever was that she had for him, her lust, her desire, was soon transformed into hate. I'm here to tell you, the one who lusts after you does not necessarily love you. That young man may say, you know what, I love you. And I wouldn't do this with anybody but you because I love you so much. He is lying through his teeth. He's lying through his teeth. Because here's what happens. Lust seeks gratification. Love cares about the person. She didn't care about him at all. Joseph may have seen this before, but he looks back with greater clarity than he's ever seen before. Joseph is on the outside now, and he can look back and he now knows, I know the difference between love and lust. Friend, I would that you understood that before you have to run outside. Not be clouded by the lust and the desires and the raging hormones to the point you begin to think, you know what, I think we're in love. There's a big difference. There's a big difference. Secondly, Joseph gets on the outside and he can look back and he can see what he lost. You know, he left some things inside. When he got outside, he didn't have time to take everything. He took some things. The most obvious is the fact that he left his coat inside, his garment inside. She's got it in her hand. She's reaching for him to embrace him, and she grabs his garment and he runs and leaves it in her hand. I don't know what that was worth. I don't know how much it meant to him. But when he gets on the outside, he looks back and that's lost. I don't have that anymore. Tell you something else he lost. He lost his job. Pretty good job at that. Pretty prestigious job. He's basically second in command. Like being chief of staff of the White House and you walk out and you've lost your job. Evidence he lost his job, he's in prison now, verse 20. He don't have that prestigious job anymore. There's something else he left inside, and that is he left his freedom. He was a free man. He could do anything he wanted. In fact, the master told him, you can touch and have anything you want except my wife. He could roam the countryside. He could do anything he wanted, and he's lost his freedom. When he fled and ran outside, he left his freedom inside. That was the last of his freedom. He lost it. And I'll tell you something else he lost. He lost his standing and his approval among men, beginning at verse 14. You say, really? Don't you remember her lying? And called the men of the house and said, he tried to rape me. They think he's an attempted rapist. And goes to the master, who had such confidence and trust in him, and she says the same thing to him. And so his standing and his approval among men that he had worked among in the palace and those that knew him and revered him, now his standing and his approval among men is gone. He's lost it. He left a lot in that house. Left his garment. Lost his job. He left his freedom. He left his standing and approval among men. Here's something I learned from that. You may lose some things too when you resist and you run outside. You may lose your boyfriend. And he may say to you, I'm done with you. You may lose your girlfriend. You may lose your standing among your friends who said, you know what, you're the only one that has never done this. The rest of us have. What are you waiting on? What are you afraid of? And you may lose some things too. And you may get on the outside and say, you know what, I've lost my friends, lost my boyfriend, I lost my girlfriend. But I want to tell you what he lost is not worth what he took with him. Because when he got on the outside, he can look back and he can see a third thing. And I don't know if you ever recognized it or not, but he took some things out with him that he didn't leave back there. We talk about him leaving that garment. But I want to tell you something he took out with him. He took his purity with him. He didn't leave that. He could have left that inside. He could have said, okay, I'll lie with you. And then when he went outside after she's done with him, he would have left his purity inside. But he brought his purity out with him. Joseph, a pure man. He brought that out with him. Tell you what else he brought out. He brought his honor with him. Remember Proverbs 6? Remember those three chapters I said we'd talk about? Chapter 6 says, the man who succumbs to the harlot, wounds and dishonor will he get. evidence? David himself said concerning his sin with Bathsheba, my sin is ever before me, Psalm 51:3. There was this dishonor he carried with him. Joseph got on the outside and he can look and say, you know what? I left my coat, left my job, but I brought my honor out with me. That's worth more than a job. It's worth more than your freedom. I'll tell you something else he brought out with him. He brought his conscience with him. Joseph is not sitting there with his head buried in his hand wondering, how did I do this? What have I done? How did this happen? I didn't see it coming. What am I going to do? Tell you something else he brought out with him. He may have lost his standing among men, but he kept his reputation among the godly. Evidence? We're talking about him this morning, aren't we? We hold him up as a revered example to follow, don't we? Recorded in Genesis 39 for all generations to read, what a reputation to have of the reputation of Joseph in Genesis 39. He brought that out with him. He brought that out with him. And I'll tell you one last thing he brought with him. And that is his relationship to God. I want you to notice at the end of the chapter now. Had he left his purity inside and his honor inside, he would have left his relationship with God inside as well. But when he came outside, he brought his relationship with his God with him. Evidence when he cast into prison. It didn't take long till he rose in prominence in the prison and they put all the prisoners into his hand. And the prisoner I'm reading at the end of chapter 39 did not look into anything that was done under Joseph's hand because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it to prosper. The Lord was blessing him, and the Lord was doing everything he could to bless this man because of the life that he lived. When Joseph got outside, the results were clear. He now sees the difference in love and lust. He sees what he left inside, and he sees what he brought with him. That's the seduction of Joseph. The temptation was strong. The resistance was firm. And the results were clear. Now I want you to listen carefully to this point, and the lesson is yours. You've heard me say before that there, when I first started preaching the gospel, I wondered, why do you preach on fornication? Because everybody here knows. If we took a show of hands, does anybody not know fornication is a sin? I don't think we'd see a single hand. We all know that. And so I wondered, why preach on that? Preach on something people don't know about. And what good does it do to preach to a crowd of people who already know this is sinful to remind them it's sinful? What good does that do? There was a survey made a number of years ago among the college students across the land, college and universities, of how many of them committed the sin of fornication. And whatever that number was, I don't remember the number, but it was a pretty significant number, pretty high percentage of the college students that were involved in fornication. So some of them, I put in quotations, brethren who operated schools among churches of Christ, like David Lipscomb, Fried Hardeman, Harding, Ohio Christian College, that's just a sampling of dozens of those across the country. They decided they would make the same survey among those students to see what the percentage was, and it was significantly lower than the national average. So the survey sought to find out why that's true. Why is it that you, as young people going to universities, do not commit the sin of fornication at the same rate that the national average is? And the answers were varied. Some said, our Bible class teachers really made an impact on us. Others said, our parents just drove it into our heads. And others said we're afraid of pregnancy. And others said afraid of venereal disease. And others said it was the peer pressure was different and lower for us than it was for the national average. Number one answer, surprising. Pulpit preaching and teaching on the subject. And so why do I preach this? I preach some lesson similar to this in every meeting I go in. And the reason for it is that if we could salvage one person, there may be one person here, it may be a middle-aged person, maybe a young person, who 10 years from now don't even remember where they heard the principle. That doesn't matter. They don't remember the sermon. But they remember something about Joseph and the resisting with words, resisting with deeds, and we avoid one sin and we spare one life. then it's worth us sitting here listening to a sermon about fornication. If we could just spare one life, just one. And it may be your child, it may be your grandchild, it may be you. Somewhere down the line, you don't even remember where you heard the point, but you remember Genesis 39 and the seduction of Joseph, and you say, that temptation was strong, but I want to be just as firm in my resistance. And you say no, our time has been well spent. There may be one or more present who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come this morning believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? If you're subject in any way, would you come while together we stand and sing?